Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're going to hear some bird calls today. We're going to talk about birds of summer and what premier birding expert Ken Kaufman did at the Prairie Rose Farm this weekend. Ken is the author of the Kaufman Field Guide to Birds of North America, among other guides. He is with us now from his home near Lake Erie in Northwest Ohio. Welcome to the show, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
You said that when you were listening to me whistle at the top of the hour, you weren't sure.
It was a very good whistle. I was impressed.
Thank you. I've been working on it for years. I've gone through three dogs with that whistle. last time I heard on Facebook, you and your spouse, Kim, were prepping for a weekend at Prairie Rose Farm with the Ohio Young Birders Club. You said it was a rare opportunity. What did you do?
Oh, well, this is one of the highlights of the year for us. The Ohio Young Birders Club it's only been around for about 4.5 years, and my wife, Kimberly, was one of the founders of it. It was organized under the management of the Black Swamp Bird Observatory with a lot of partners from all over the state. But it's a neat program that it's for kids ages 12 to 18. And most of the field trips during the year are just day trips, but every summer we'll have a camp out at this private property called Prairie Rose Farm. And it's a neat opportunity because we're out in this relatively wild habitat. There's woods, there's a creek, there's native prairie, and it's a safe enough area that the kids can just sort of run around, and you know, they don't need to be directly supervised by adults every second. Although we did a lot of organized things. We were seining in the creek to see what fish were there. We mist-netted bats to examine them up close. We had black lights out for moths, and of course we were bird watching too. But just really, really a great experience.
Seining in the creek. Did I mispronounce that? And what does that mean exactly?
Oh, there's this just a device, sort of this finely meshed net that you sort of drag through a little section of the creek to see what critters you can pull up.
Creaking. You went creaking.
I'm sorry?
Creaking.
Yeah, creaking. Creaking, yeah. Seining. But the people who own the farm are biologists, and so they, you know, they won't, this is all, it's not damaging the environment or anything, but we just pull up all these minnows mm-hmm. and things and then try to identify them, and we look at the crawdads and things.
Now, I also read you were banding bats, weren't you?
That's right. There was a biologist who came out and put up mist nets, and then just after dark we were catching bats, and he puts little markers, little metal bands over the leading edge of the forewing, so those same individual bats can be identified if they're found again later.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Ken Kaufman, naturalist and author of the Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America. Welcome your questions, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and do your business there. Ken, when I ask people for questions, I'm wondering, what are some of the most typical questions you got from people? I was actually inspired by the top 10 myths on the Bird Digest website. Do you get a lot of the same questions over and over again?
Well, often it's a question about, I saw this bird in my yard and it was all brown, and what kind was it? And then there's how do I get rid of the crows around my place? And I'm not good at those, you know. I'm getting rid of birds is not one of my specialties.
They were talking about myths. Are there any common misperceptions about birds?
Yeah, probably quite a few. I mean, I don't think most people realize just how many different kinds of birds there are. And so, you know, they sort of assume that, well, if it's a little bird and it was all gray, it should be easy to say what kind it was. Even though there may be 40 or 50 kinds of little gray birds that are possible around here. A lot of people don't realize how much goes on with migration and just how many birds are actually moving around at all times of year. And the fact that a lot of our common summer birds here go off to South America for the winter.
Migration's occurring all the time.
Pretty much. I mean, there are some low points in late June, there aren't too many birds actually migrating because most of them are active. You know, they're nesting at that point. Mm-hmm. And there's a little while in late January when there's not much movement going on. But the rest of the year, there's some birds that are on their way somewhere.
It has been so hot here. I don't know about out there. How about you?
Yeah.
And muggy, you know, it's the quote-unquote humidity and all that kind of stuff. Does that affect birds?
It affects the bird watchers more, I think.
We don't see as many birds because we're not out looking for them.
That's right. I mean, we went ahead with our camp out this weekend, and it was fine. It was a little bit warm, but the birds that were nesting, their house wrens nesting in bird houses all over the place out of Prairie Rose Farm. And the house wrens, the males are just singing away, just that bubbling song. They're full of energy, and they're dashing around and bringing food to the young birds in the nest boxes. So they don't seem to be slowed down by the heat at all.
We have an email now. If you'd like to email us, allsides@wosu.org, and this is from Alex. Alex writes, "Are cormorants, is that how I pronounce it?
Cormorants.
Cormorants, becoming a problem in central Ohio. I'm beginning to see them more frequently along the Scioto, and some websites say they're a major problem on Lake Erie."
They are increasing in numbers, but I would definitely not say that they're a problem of any kind in central Ohio. There's I mean, I like to see them. They're they're very interesting birds, very angular and sort of reptilian. And they feed on fish, but it's almost entirely fish that are not of interest to anglers and that don't have any commercial value. So they don't really compete with humans. The only thing that ever happens with cormorants where they're a problem is in some places they'll move into a nesting colony of herons and egrets, and there'll be so many nests of cormorants, and their droppings are particularly potent.
Okay.
So often they wind up like killing the trees. And so places
really?
Where herons have been nesting in trees for years, cormorants will move in and all the trees die, and eventually you lose the nesting habitat. But it takes a really big concentration to do that.
I'm looking at page 69 on your Field Guide to Birds of North America, looking at the pictures of cormorants. And now I get it. I see what you mean by reptilian. They're one of those kind of birds that remind you of the link to the dinosaurs.
Exactly.
Strange little beak.
Yeah, but they're very good at they're very fast swimmers underwater and very good at catching fish.
You mean they swim underwater?
Yeah, they're very good at it. They dive and swim underwater. They fold their wings in tight against their body, and they paddle with their feet. And that sort of long tail helps them steer. And they're very fast in the water.
Yeah, the long tail looks like a paddle, sort of, a rudder more like, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is the Kaufman Field Guide to Birds of North America. I'm not pitching it for a membership drive or anything. I'm just looking at it. Just chatting with Ken today. Don't be afraid. Tell me about banding the bats, and were the kids afraid, or am I just visualizing very much younger kids and actually it wasn't that bad at all with them?
Yeah, I mean, they weren't afraid of them, partly because, you know, getting them up close, most of the bats they were catching were the little brown bats, which are really tiny creatures. I mean, they really are mouse-sized, and with the wings and so on, they're not that much bigger than, you know, I mean, they're certainly smaller than robins. And the biologist who came out who was doing the actual banding of the bats is very experienced, and so he was handling them and just, you know, showing them to the kids, and everyone was just fascinated by it.
Their faces are kind of cute when you actually get a good look at them.
Yeah, they really are.
Sort of expressive.
Mm-hmm. They're very, very interesting animals and, you know, unique. I mean, we say that they're like flying mice, but they're certainly not related to mice at all.
Let's listen now to a cut we have. I promised everybody bird sounds. So this is from a house wren in Maryland. Sounds like a little fly or a bumblebee mixed up in that, too.
No, there's often other stuff in the background of these recordings, yeah. But it's this really energetic, bubbling song, and I can tell you that the house wrens out at Prairie Rose Farm were starting to do that about 5:30 in the morning the last couple of days. And they were singing continuously and loudly from directly above the tents. And so they're still very much some birds are finished up with their nesting by this time in the summer, but the house wrens are still very busy at it.
Now, that sound of the house wren, is that just one of many sounds they make?
That's the typical song, okay. And it varies individually. If you were to record them and analyze them, you'd find little subtle differences between the different males. But that's their territorial song that they do in summer, and then they have just a variety of call notes and scolding notes they'll do at other times of year.
You know, something that finally sunk in to me when I was interviewing Cy Montgomery a few months ago, and I shared this with Julie Zickafoos as well, is I finally get it that every bird is an individual.
They really are, yeah. And that's, Cy knows that, Julie knows that. If you deal with birds as individuals, it's so easy to just sort of lump them and say, well, that's the house wren, that's how it behaves. But each individual is going to have its own personality.
And then its own little variations in sound.
That's true, yeah. I mean, the birds can recognize each other individually. Where you have a big nesting colony of something like gulls and maybe thousands of pairs there. When the adult birds come back, they can recognize their own chick by the sound it makes. And the chick can recognize its parents by voice, even among this huge cloud of birds that all sound the same to us.
I was reading somewhere about how the sounds that birds make or the calls that they make out to each other can also signal different kinds of things like changes in the numbers of birds out there. If there's a lot of new birds coming into an area, they speak differently to intruders than they do with birds that are already around.
That's true. At least in some cases they do. And they've got, it turns out there's more meaning to bird voices than we once thought. And the birds do have different calls they use in different situations. And it's almost like a language. They can't, you know, discuss philosophy or anything. Or if they do, they're not doing it on a word round.
Yeah, well, that's about par for the course among a lot of people anyways. But let's take a break right now. Give us a call or email us. Call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you have a question or comment for Ken Kaufman, author of The Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820.
We know you're all great listeners, but that's not all you do. We know you love to talk, yak, argue, gossip, debate, explore, and exchange. Here at Talk of the Nation, you get to do all of that. Join guest host Tony Cox to contribute your 2 cents. That's coming up on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
And Talk of the Nation will be here at 2 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Currently 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:19 this morning. Sunshine today at a high of 85. Clear skies tonight and a low of 62 degrees. Sunshine for Tuesday as well and a high of 88. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Kaufman, naturalist and author of The Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America. Welcome your questions, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Sandy Bowers, I think it's the Philadelphia Inquirer. She's
right.
A columnist there. She wrote earlier this month about you. She said that talking about how you believe that the more we can identify our fellow creatures, the more connected we come with our environment. And you said something about knowing at least 50.
Yeah, that was a challenge I've put out a couple of times in a couple of different interviews that have been published. I haven't really worked up the idea and tried to promote it, but Sandy Bowers, I guess, was taken by it and wanted to quote the idea. Just the thought that if everyone could learn to recognize 50 different species of plants and animals that are found in our own local area, you know, actually, you know, see them and recognize what we're seeing, I think it would make for a profound change in the way we interact with the world. I think we would feel a lot more connected to our surroundings, and we'd have a better understanding of why it's important to protect the environment.
She talked about how some kids go to the zoo and they're afraid of the animals inside the cages.
Yeah, and for some people, I mean, zoos are great, but for some people, that's as close as they ever get to nature. And if you start to ask some kids, well, what can you find in this area? What are some plants and animals that you find here, you know, close to where you live in Ohio? And they'll start thinking, they know about polar bears and they know about whales and so on, but they haven't seen some of the fascinating things that live right here. And I just think that connection is sort of missing, and it really makes me sad when I talk to people who say, yeah, I'm really interested in nature and I watch nature shows on television, but they won't turn around and look out the window to see, you know, what's out there.
Right, and it is so interesting that you just outside your own window, how many birds are out there. We've taken them for granted. They're almost like white noise.
That's right, but they, you know, if we paid more attention, they would really really make our world more three-dimensional and more interesting.
You became interested very young, early teens or younger even.
I didn't really focus in on birds until I was about six.
That old?
I'm sorry. Yeah, I was wasted.
What were you wasting exactly? And then you got off into insects as well, and I was interested. You just happened to have written about the snowberry clearwing.
Yeah.
And I came across a snowberry clearwing, didn't know what the heck it was. I thought it was a little hummingbird years ago. Funny enough, it was hanging around the plant you use in your picture in the Facebook. I always call it the Phyllis Diller plant because it's very crazy looking. Bee bomb.
Oh, yeah.
It always looks like one of those wigs that Phyllis Diller used to wear. Anyways, that's where I saw the first clearwing, snowberry clearwing, and I finally identified it just a few weeks ago when I was visiting in West Virginia. But that's what got you fascinated in butterflies and bugs?
Yeah. I mean, I was at that point, I was 13. I'd been a rabid bird watcher for 7 years, and I wouldn't look at other stuff. But I was we were visiting some cousins in Arkansas, and all these, and so the boys are out there. We were proving just how macho we were by catching bumblebees in jars, and then letting them go without getting stung, hopefully. And I noticed this one thing that hovered. It looked like a bumblebee, but it was hovering in front of the flowers instead of landing on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked closely and had this sort of inkling of something I'd seen in a book somewhere that it might be a moth instead. So I caught it. And decided that, yeah, it didn't look like a bee. So I made a bet with the other boys that, I could let this thing crawl on my hand and it wouldn't sting me. So I did. You know, they took me up on it, and I didn't get stung. So it was fascinating to see this. And I made a nickel off of it. So, so of course I was hooked.
A capitalist naturalist is born.
That's right.
Whenever I've seen one, they're moving very quickly, just like a hummingbird. How did you get those pictures of them quiet?
The pictures that I had online recently, I was following one around. I was out in the Oak Openings area just west of Toledo, and I was following one around in this field for about half an hour and would occasionally get a good clear shot of it hovering. And finally it landed, and I took some pictures of it sitting on a leaf.
That's amazing to see it quiet like that. 614-292-8513. Give us a call if you have a question or comment for Ken Kaufman. We have him on for the rest of the hour. He's the author of The Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America. Let's hear from another bird now. This is recorded in Ohio. It's the indigo bunting. That's very pretty.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's a bad recording, but it's got a good story behind it. That recording was made more than 50 years ago by Professor Arthur Allen, who was one of the pioneers of bird sound recording. And he was one of the founders of the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. And so, you know, we could find, you know, today higher quality recordings of indigo buntings. But that one's sort of interesting because you can hear sort of the banging in the background of the, you know, the microphone banging against the parabolic reflector that they were using. And the quality of the song still comes through. It's sort of bright, cheerful sounding notes that are often sort of paired.
You knew where that recording came from?
Yeah, because I...
You've heard it a million times?
I'm not that good. It's just that I communicated with...
my producer.
At WSU ahead of time to...
Now my producer's shaking her head at me.
to find out which recordings you were going to use.
I was amazed, Ken.
I just thought that was fascinating that, you know, it was really a nice touch to get that the historic recording made in Ohio. You know, Arthur Allen, more than 50 years ago, he was out there with this sort of primitive equipment at the time and out actively following birds around, recording their voices.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Ken Kaufman and Leslie, you're on the show. Welcome.
Good morning. My question concerns nighthawks and woodcocks. The other night I was standing on my deck, and it was after dark. I mean, it had already gotten, I mean, the sun had set. There was no light in the sky. It was pretty dark. And I thought I heard a woodcock. My wife said, no, you probably heard a nighthawk. And I thought, well, wait a minute. Do we have nighthawks that much around this part of Ohio, west of Columbus? And then when I looked it up in one of 20 bird books that we have, one bird book said it's difficult to tell the difference between the two, so I wondered if there was a way to be able to do that.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. I mean, the woodcocks and the common nighthawks both do call at night, and they both have this buzzy note that you could write sort of as a peent. It tends to be more just on one pitch when the woodcock does it, just peent, and the nighthawk has more of a, it's slightly downslurred at the end, a slightly longer note. The woodcocks don't call very much at this time of year. They're most vocal. They come back really early in spring.
We used to lay out at a pasture by a river in the spring because they're mating. They fly up in the air and make a circle, and then when they dive, the wind whistles through their wings, I think, or on their tail. It makes a very distinct sound. And then they get down on the ground and they walk around in a circle again.
Exactly. Yeah, so you're very familiar with that sky dance. It's really one of the amazing phenomena of spring.
It's one of the neat things to do it in the spring on a nice starry night, just before it gets dark, to go out and lay down and just look up in the air, and just sort of stare at nothing.
Are those nighthawks? Is that what you're talking about, nighthawks?
Those are the American woodcock.
Woodcock, right, okay. It says nighthawks are not related to hawks.
That's right, yeah. And the woodcock is actually a kind of sandpiper that's adapted to live in the woods instead of out on the beach, so everything here is confusing.
Well, Leslie, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
Take care. 614-292-8513. And Joanne, welcome to the show.
Hello. Can you identify the attractive beetles that show up every year on my butterfly weed? They are orange and black, but at each of several life stages, the markings and colors are just a little different. The tiny babies, maybe an eighth of an inch long, are a dark orange with no black, and as toddlers, they have a little more black, and as teenagers, still more. And then the adults have this rather a mathematical black and orange pattern.
Yeah, actually, that sounds like By coincidence, it sounds like the creature that's on the front cover of my field guide to insects in North America. And it's called the large milkweed bug. And they look a lot like beetles, but they're actually in a different group, the Hemiptera, the true bugs. And you find all the different life stages living together on the plant, the way you describe.
Exactly. Well, thank you very much.
Well, that's a good observation.
614-292-8513. Thank you very much for that call. Or go to allsides@wosu.org if you'd rather email us your question or comment. You were teaching two sessions you wrote at Migrant School earlier, I think this month, or maybe it was in June. It's for the children of migrant farm workers who are just spending the summer in Northwest Ohio. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I was really blessed to have a chance to do that. There are a couple of migrant schools that I know of up in our area, one in Fremont and one in Woodmore. And actually, friends of ours from the National Wildlife Refuge have been going down to the one in Fremont. But a friend is associated with the Woodmore School and just asked me to come out and talk to a couple of classes. And one was like 4th, 5th, 6th grades, and the others were teenagers. And just a great bunch of kids. They really had great questions. And we were actually talking more about what it's like to be an author, to make one's living writing. And I was writing, the stuff that I write is all about birds and nature, so we were talking about that too. But I was encouraging them to, you can notice things about nature and come up with material and things to write about. I mean, I've been doing it for years and I haven't run out of material yet. but it was really interesting to hear the kinds of questions they had. There were a couple of teenage girls there who were working together on trying to write a novel already. And this is, they're working long hours.
The kids are working too.
The teenagers are. Uh-huh. Yeah, they're working long hours out there in the fields with their parents and then coming back at night and sitting there and trying to work on writing a novel. And they had questions about, okay, well, how do you deal with agents and editors? And I thought, wow, these kids are sharp.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a great experience to get to talk with them.
Did you talk at all about some of the birds and things they might have seen in their travels?
Yeah, we did. Some of the kids were from Texas and some were from Florida, and so we talked about migratory birds that move back and forth between Ohio and areas farther south, and talked about sort of compared it to their travels with the seasons.
Yeah, exactly. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu. And Rich, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was going to ask Ken about an observation I'm sure every birdwatcher has, which is that in movies, quite frequently, the background track includes animal sounds, often birds. But usually, in my experience at least, they tend to be birds that are commonly encountered wherever the movie producers made the movie. In other words, things like English species of birds will show up in the background of movies that are supposed to be in India or Australia or somewhere. Most recently, I guess I was watching the Hurt Locker, and right in one of the tense scenes where they're out in the desert and it's relatively quiet, and you're listening to the silence, basically, a cactus wren sings in the background, and I'm going, oh, come on. I mean, this is a movie that, one of the premier movies of the last year, right? I mean,
yeah, it won the Academy Award, right?
Yet they can't even get a bird that's from the same continent in the background. It just drives me nuts, and this happens all the time.
You must be tortured.
Later on in the same week, with watching a repeat of The Bourne Identity, and there's a scene where they're in, I think, southern France, I can't remember exactly where. And there's another one of these tense, quiet scenes where you tend to hear the background. And there's sort of two characters chasing each other through this field. And there's a blue jay calling in the background. I'm going, and it's not a European jay, which they could have used. And there are plenty of good recordings of European jays. It would have been a nice, or a rook or something. it could have been calling in the background, but I'm sure you observed that. It's just so distracting to watch movies because they never seem to do that. So I think you need to form a new company to consult on movie soundtracks to be sure that appropriate animal sounds are actually included. It's really annoying.
Ken, does it torture you this way?
Well, it's bizarre that, you know, if you look at, with a lot of films, they'll go to great lengths to research the, you know, if it's something that happened more than 10 years ago, there's great research about having exactly the right cars mm-hmm. in place and the right costumes and everything, and they, you know, making sure that the cowboys, you know, riding on the range aren't wearing digital wristwatches, and you know, they really pay attention to all these details. But then something as basic as the typical sounds of an area. I mean, even if you don't know, even if you don't know what a cactus wren sounds like, or if you've been to an area, you know, if you've been in southern France and you've heard sounds there that you weren't hearing blue jays. So getting the atmosphere right, having the right bird sounds for the area would make a difference for anyone who's paying attention, even if they're not bird watchers. And then you've got, you know, tens of thousands of really keen birders out there who are watching the movie and hearing this and saying, well, you know, why can't they get this right?
Going bonkers. You know, it reminds me of a time when I was covering the prison riot down at Lucasville, Lord knows how many years ago now, 15 or so years ago, and some out-of-state reporter was referring to the crickets. Well, that night, it was so cold you could break the ice in the puddles. I'm like, there are no crickets out here. So, Rich, I think I kind of get what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's very distracting. It kind of takes away, especially when you realize how much money they spend on these things. I think I'd like to be cut in on some of that money just to get them the right sound.
You could be a gaffer on their bird sounds.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Thanks
There really are some amazing examples of it, and some in some it gets to where it's almost comical. I mean, years ago I was dragged to some chick movie called Crimes of the Heart. By some former girlfriend, and I have no idea what happened in the movie, but it was supposed to be taking place somewhere in the South, and out in the background, you're hearing all these different things like, you know, common loons yodeling, and the songs of sandpipers fluttering over the Arctic tundra, and songs of northern prairie sparrows, and just, it was like a cacophony of bird sounds with almost nothing that actually would be found in the South.
Well,
just amazing.
You know, the thing that always got me about the Tarzan movies was the kookaburras in the background.
That's right.
And also pied-billed grebes. Those are two very jungly-sounding animals, even though neither of them lives in what you really call a jungle, and nothing like Africa. But the iconic sounds of the jungle that most of us know from those early movies are not even jungle sounds. If you played a kookaburra to almost anyone who hadn't heard one in Australia or wasn't familiar with Australian birds, I think you'd probably get 2/3 of these people would recognize the sound, and they would say, oh, that's from
Johnny Weissmuller.
Yeah, you're right. You know, there have been some good examples, of it being done well. The director, Jane Campion, did a film called The Piano.
Yes.
Yeah, it had wonderful New Zealand birds, tuis and things in the background. That was
exactly,
great.
Yeah. It was set in Australia, and all the bird sounds in the background that I could identify, they were all New Zealand birds. So it was really well done.
Yeah.
It's a fabulous film.
Some of them make an effort, some don't.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it has a lot to do with the respect for the environment, the respect, their own personal knowledge of it.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm sure that's true. And I just wish that, I wish Hollywood had more respect for the natural environment.
Yep. Rich, thanks for your call.
Oh, you're welcome.
Take care. We're going to have to take a break, but before we do, we'll go out with the Purple Martin and talk about that when we return to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
We can be so closed in. And when you listen to WOSU, they address things from more than one point of view. It's a global point of view, and you realize that you are indeed a citizen of the world and not just a citizen of Columbus, Ohio. My name is Joyce Eubanks, and WOSU is my source for a world view.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about human service organizations in Franklin County and serving people from all walks of life, along with advocating for public policy to protect vulnerable members of society and improve their quality of life. That discussion begins at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Meijer, helping people make environmentally friendly choices with Meijer EcoWise laundry care, cleaners, paper products, and more. Meijer EcoWise products help lessen the negative impact on our environment, because no effort is too small.
Discover more about WOSU Public Media online at WOSU.org. Sign up for the Daily News Loop for updates sent right to your inbox. Get the best in WOSU and NPR news and information every weekday. Sign up at WOSU.org. 75 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today, and a high of 85. All Sides continues on WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Kaufman, naturalist and author of the Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America and many other field guides. Ken, the purple martin. Why is it called the purple martin? Is that, it looks almost black in your book.
Yeah, well, it generally does. It's a large kind of swallow, and martin and swallow are terms that are used almost interchangeably in Europe. We call most of our swallows just swallows, but the purple martin, it's a big one. It's near the size of a robin, and if you get a good look at a male in good light, that black plumage has sort of purple reflections on it.
Mm-hmm. The sound that it makes, I notice in your field guide to birds of North America that you try to emulate the sounds, and for the purple martin, it's dezeeb dezer.
You know, you heard the recording. It's a little hard to put that into letters, but trying to get something across. There's sort of a burry sound to it. And you can hear them a lot, especially early in the morning.
Uh-huh.
They start flying around just before daylight, and the males will be flying high over the nesting colonies and calling. And I just like the sound.
Some birds sound at different times, typically?
Yeah, they're you often get different kinds of vocalizations different times of day, and some birds are really extreme about it. There's some of the flycatchers that have a dawn song that you never hear at any other time, and others it's just like more a preference, and they tend to do a different call at a different time of day.
Let's hear one from the chimney swift now, and then we'll get to some of those calls. This is the chimney swift. It was recorded in West Virginia. That's almost like a Morse code.
Yeah, it's a rapid chippering sound, and one reason that I thought it would be interesting to listen to chimney swift is that they're mostly city and town birds in Ohio now. In places where they nest, they nest in chimneys, and so you can see them flying over cities and suburbs, especially in the evening. And they're starting to gather in communal roosts now, and it's a bird that you could see from literally any backyard in the state of Ohio. So it's a good bird for people to know about.
Where would they be in the wild?
Well, historically, they nested in hollow trees. But as long ago as 200 years ago, they were already making the switch to nesting in chimneys because the large, dead hollow trees were disappearing as the primeval forest was cut down. But chimneys were being put up on buildings all over the continent, and they put their nest, they stick their nest to the inside of the chimney using their own sticky saliva, which dries really, really hard. And so they'll nest inside the chimneys. And These days, there are very few that still nest in hollow trees.
It's pretty amazing how quickly they can adapt.
Oh, yeah. It's encouraging, too.
614-292-8513. And Carol, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great, show this morning.
Thank you.
I have a friend, and I've had her for 20 years, and that relationship's about to end because she gets hummingbirds and I don't. I use the same feeder. I use the same nectar. Now, the difference in our properties is that I have about 22 old, really tall trees. I have a dog. I have lots of squirrels and things like that, but I have no hummingbirds. And she boasts about the fact that they...
Well, she's a braggart.
Perch, and they're there all the time, and she almost can't get rid of them. They're such a nuisance, and it just makes me crazy. What am I doing wrong?
Well, do you have much in the way of flowers in the yard?
No.
Because that could make a big difference. I mean, the hummingbirds, they like the feeders, but they may not find them unless they're lured into the area by... especially if you had some sort of patch of bright red flowers, something like bee balm or a cardinal flower or trumpet creeper.
Okay.
A trumpet creeper vine is great for bringing hummingbirds into the neighborhood.
I see. She does have the planters, the boxes that hang from her fence, and she's just loaded with petunias, and they're gorgeous.
Yeah, and petunias aren't particularly good hummingbird. They're not particularly good hummingbird flowers, but if you have a splash of color, it brings the birds in. I mean, you could try to fake them out by just hanging up bright red stuff in the trees.
But,
well, there's lots of shade, so it's probably hard to grow, but maybe just fake them out with, like, impatiens or something like that?
Yeah. That would be a good idea. Or put up multiple feeders and make sure that the red parts of the feeders are easy to see from a distance.
Okay. That is definitely the difference. Thank you very much for information.
Carol,
good luck with it. I hope that this friendship can be saved.
Me too. They're hard to find. 20 years, that's a nice, good, long run.
Thank you again.
Take care. 614-292-8513. And welcome to the show. Jerry, you're on the air.
Good morning, Ms. Fisher, and your guest. I haven't heard this sound of a bird since I was a youngster, and that's with a Red Ryder BB gun, which I didn't shoot the birds, but it goes like this. Whippoorwill.
A whippoorwill.
Are they still around?
Their numbers have dropped a lot in the last few decades. They used to be really common forest birds in Ohio, and their numbers have really, really declined sharply. Yeah. And nobody knows exactly why. They fly around at night feeding on insects, and some of the large nighttime insects, like the large moths and beetles, may be a lot less numerous than they used to be.
We just heard one night at twilight down in West Virginia. It was so obvious. It was very clear and really wonderful to listen to it.
Interesting. Yeah, I always enjoyed them as a young boy, listening to them and laying in bed at night and listening to them. But Ken, maybe you can tell me, who said that this sound is the true symbol of the wilderness? I know I read that someplace many years ago, and I've heard many a loon. Who said that?
Oh, that's a good question. I've heard that. That quote is familiar.
Is that a loon? Let's just...
Yeah,
okay.
A common loon, and it is the true voice of the wilderness, but somebody said that in writing. I'm trying to think who it was, whether it was like Sigurd Olsen.
It could have been either Sigurd. Yeah, it might have been Sigurd Olsen or, I can't think of the other guy's name, Calvin Rutstrom. Have you read his books?
No, I know the name, but I haven't actually read the book.
Yeah, and I wanted to mention one other thing. Several years ago, I was able to drive, good eyesight then, went up to a little town of Mio, M-I-O, Michigan, and went out with a guide from the National Forest there and saw a Kirtland's warbler.
wonderful bird.
Yeah, and at that time, I don't know what the population is now, but there were less than 500 around the country, and they only nest in that in those jack pines, and if they get over 15, 20 feet tall, they leave. It's an and by the way, it was named after Dr. Kirtland, who was from Ohio.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Jared Kirtland from Cleveland, and the bird was found as a migrant long before its nesting grounds were ever discovered.
Right, yeah.
One piece of good news about Kirtland's warbler is that its population is actually increasing somewhat. I mean, you're right, the total numbers were down to, you know, scary low populations, under 500 in the 1980s, but now it's up close to 3,000.
Yeah,
so
if you want to
really done well.
Yeah, you know where Mayo is, Miss Fisher?
I don't.
Well, it's you go up 30 State Route 33, I think it is, through get off at Sterling, Michigan, off at 75, and then there's this road that goes straight up, and you'll end up in Mayo. I think it's Oscoda County. By the way, it's the only county that still has a frame courthouse. Last time I was there, I haven't heard that it's burned down, but it's right on the Aussable River.
Aussable River, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Blue Ribbon Trout Stream. Oh, you ought to take the trip. Enjoy it.
Jerry, we've got other calls. Thanks for your call, Jerry.
I appreciate it.
Take care. 614. Well, I'm not even going to give the number out because we have so many calls now. I'm never going to get to all of them. Amy, welcome to the show.
Hello. Hi. I was recently kayaking on the Big Walnut Creek in Galena.
Mm hmm.
And under a bridge, there were tons and tons of these birds all embedded in the bridge. And they have these nests that almost look like a beehive with a hole in them. What were they making their nests out of?
Yeah, those would be cliff swallows. And cliff swallows, they're nesting under bridges now because bridges are easier to find than cliffs. And they make their nests out of mud. They pick up pellets of mud and build this thing. As you describe, it's like a beehive with a hole in the side. And that's where they raise their young.
And they're cliff what?
Cliff swallows.
Swallows, okay.
All right.
Thanks,
okay. Amy. Take care. Let's see. What's next? Dan, I think. Dan, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was calling to see if either of you know if this Division of Wildlife, is part of ODNR, put out years ago a Bird Songs of Ohio. It's a CD, and it has about 50 different bird songs and a nice little booklet along with it that has a color picture of the bird and information about that bird. I can't find a date on it, but it was, it shows Bob Taft as governor.
Well, that was a few years back, 4 or 5 maybe at least, over the course of 8 years. Ken, are you familiar with that?
Yeah, well, they've continued to do that. Division of Wildlife actually puts out a whole series of little publications, little booklets and CDs, and they continue to bring out new ones. They've got a brand new one now on the spiders of Ohio, but they've done a number on birds. So they've got the CD for owls, they've got a CD for water birds, and they still have the common birds of Ohio. And they're free if you just contact Division of Wildlife. You can get copies of those.
Dan, thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
And Bob, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Just a follow-up. I have that book that guy was just talking about. I was down in the wilds. And, yes, you can get these books free. They didn't have the CDs at the time. But if you wanted a phone number, or go to WW Wilds of Ohio, and you can get the CD with it.
Okay.
The other thing, I used to work at Perry's and Victory International Peace Memorial, familiar with Maggie Marsh or McGee Marsh, and I was wondering if Ken was worried about the huge amount of people that go there during the spring migration. I've been there a number of times, and generally I only go one day. I try to go early because there can be 5,000 cars in the parking lot.
Yeah, well, you know, actually...
Is that a slight exaggeration, Bob?
let's say 5,000. Yeah,
okay.
Let's say 5,000 people.
Okay.
Yeah, I think actually the parking lot only holds about 800 or 900 cars. But
there you go.
But actually, no, that's a situation where we're actually encouraging people to come there because the McGee Marshes, it's an interesting situation because the migrant songbirds really gather in the woodlot there. They really concentrate in big numbers. But the access is carefully controlled by this boardwalk that winds around through the woods.
Yes.
And people don't go off the boardwalk, so there's no damage to the habitat being done. And the birds are obviously not too disturbed by the presence of all these people because they'll feed, they'll be foraging in the trees and bushes like right along the boardwalk and right along the edge of the parking lot for, you can birdwatch the edge of the parking lot for half a mile. And the birdwatching community is pretty well self-policing, and so people just don't go tramping off through the woods. And the habitat is well protected, and it's a great place to introduce people to birds. We've had lots of absolute beginners and first-time birdwatchers come there, and they get great looks at birds during the spring migration. And we hope that it gets them excited about birds and nature to the extent that they'll become conservationists. So I'm actually, I think the concentration of people coming there for the spring migration is a good thing. It's not harming the habitat or the birds.
Okay, Bob, thanks for that call. And we have email from Stephen. He says that he's heard whippoorwills off Morse Road at the Morse Road and York area regularly. So, and then looks like we're just about running out of time. So we don't have time for the Facebook message or the rest of the calls. I'm very, very sorry. Call earlier next time. Ken Kaufman is on the show. Ken, thanks again for being with us today.
Well, thanks very much, Ann.
Appreciate it. That's Ken Kaufman, naturalist and author of the Kaufman Field Guide to the Birds of North America and other field guides. We'll be meeting him again later, I hope. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.